Mountain is brought to you by Alpkit. Last year, Alpkit started a charity. The Alpkit Foundation funds projects right across the globe, and it helps remove the barriers some people face getting outdoors. Now, that's something you've heard me say lots of times. I'm at the Kendal Mountain Festival at the moment, and I thought I'd ambush the Alpkit team and find out a bit more about why they started the charity.
My name's Kenny Stocker. I'm one of the directors at Alpkit.
What sort of projects are you interested in funding? What is a good fit for the Alpkit Foundation?
A lot of the projects that I've found most interesting will be probably ones that are being done for very personal reasons, but the knock-on effect of that funding would be that you can have an impact on a greater range of people. So it might be an instructor applying for a course to get some training that can then kind of teach a group of 10 people. We might may well be funding one person, but it's going to affect 100 people over 2 or 3 years.
So it's like it's a highly targeted donation that is going to have maximum impact. You can have that. You can use that if you want.
Yeah, what you just said.
Yeah, that's it.
Find out how you could apply for a grant at alpkit.com. That's alpkit.com. And thank you very much to Alpkit for supporting Mountain.
I was on the train reading this book for about the 20th time, daydreaming, as I always do, how nice it would be. And I just had this sudden moment of stop being so pathetic and just go do this. So I got out my phone on the train, Googled for a local violin teacher, found her email address, emailed her and said, "Hello, I want to go walk across Spain this summer in 7 months' time. Can you teach me the violin in that time?" She wrote back about 5 minutes later saying, "This is ridiculous. Come to my house tomorrow morning and we'll start."
This is Alistair Humphreys. He's an adventurer, a writer, a filmmaker. And he's a terrible violinist.
So bad. It's so bad. It's so bad.
Alistair's cycled around the world. He's trekked through deserts and rode across the Atlantic. But the decision he took on the train that day was to start preparing for a much simpler journey, an easy walk across a European country in summertime. He wanted to pay tribute to his literary hero, Laurie Lee, who left his Gloucestershire home in the 1930s to walk across Spain. It's a journey Lee recounts in his book, As I Walked Out One Midsummer Morning. Laurie Lee was penniless and busked with his violin to earn money to eat. Alistair decided he'd do the same. Laurie Lee, of course, was a pretty decent violin player. And Alistair, well...
The famous first screech, then.
Yes.
That is worse than I thought it was going to be. Oh, man.
It's fine, it's fine.
So this episode is a bit different. We're not talking about the adventure you can have crossing deserts, oceans, or mountains. We're talking about the adventure that starts with an impulsive email on a train and ends up tapping into our deepest fears. You know the fears I mean, the ones that trigger those dreams when you suddenly realise you're naked in public, the dreams that you're vulnerable, unprepared, exposed, the dreams when failure stalks your every moment.
Just want to paint myself in the past. It's so annoying.
I'm doomed. I really am doomed. I'm so bad. Oh, God.
I'm Christopher Slight, and this is Mountain. Right, Hugh Williams, would you read me some Laurie Lee?
Do you want it in my voice or do you want Gloucestershire?
No, I want it in your voice.
All right, okay. Lying safe in the old ship's blowsy care, I didn't want to move at first. I'd enjoyed the 2 slow days coming down the English Channel and across the Bay of Biscay, smelling the soft Gulf winds blowing in from the Atlantic and feeling the deep, easy roll of the ship. But this was Vigo, the name on my ticket and as far as its protection would take me. So I lay for a while in the anchored silence and listened to the first faint sounds of Spain. A howling dog, the gasping spasms of a donkey, the thin, sharp cry of a cockerel. Then I packed and went up onto the shining deck, and the Spanish sun rose too. And for the first time in my life I saw, looped round the bay, the shape of a foreign city.
It's the middle of July, and Alistair arrives in the same bay. He's been practicing his violin every day for 7 months. There are 500 miles of walking ahead of him. He has some basic camping equipment, a camera to record a video diary, and his violin. But his pockets are empty.
I had no money at all, because I knew that if I had a little reserve, if I allowed myself, say, 10 euros a day or even 10 euros a week, that would just totally take the pressure off. And the only way for it to, for the violining to feel authentic rather than just a fun little game, was for it to be everything dependent on that, or I failed. And without that, the trip would have been infinitely less exciting. So I had no money whatsoever. I obviously needed my credit card in order to fly out there. My plan was to get off the plane in Spain and elaborately cut it in half, and then I thought, I can't be bothered with the paperwork. So I put it in my inside my passport with a note saying, if you open this, the trip has failed.
I mean, this book, Laurie Lee book, is obviously really key to you. What is it about it? What's the draw for you? What's your sort of relationship with this book?
I grew up loving books and reading long before I got interested in travel and adventure. So I've always enjoyed good writing. And then I started to get into adventure, and I really loved the idea of very simple journeys, traveling slowly, and quite a romantic air to travel and adventure. Just sort of following your nose, sleeping wild, being free, being a bit of a vagabond, going where the world takes you. And if you combine that with beautiful writing, you get Laurie Lee's book.
Now, most people, when they got to the point of, oh, I can't play the violin, probably would have thought, well, there we are, there's one I'll never cross off my bucket list. But you sort of decided, right, I'm going to learn this instrument from scratch. I mean, was it totally from scratch?
It was totally from scratch. And for many years, I felt exactly the same as normal, sensible people would think, which is why it took me so long to do this trip. My thinking changed because my thinking about adventure changed. I started enjoying adventures because I wanted challenges. I wanted to do stuff that was difficult, risking failure, all the stuff that everyone thinks about with adventure. And so in order to get that in my life, I did big physical things like cycling around the world and rowing oceans. But if you do anything a lot, you get good at it. So I now know that I'm quite good at long, masochistic, physical adventures. And if you're good at it, and you know you can do it, and you're probably going to succeed, in many ways, then that's not really an adventure. You're actually just sticking in a rut, staying in your comfort zone, despite professing to live a life that is away from all those things. And I realized that if I wanted to live adventurously, as I claim to do, then I should do stuff that was challenging, scary, frightening, and risked failure, which meant learning the violin.
Here we go.
Tell me about that moment when you arrived in Vigo in Spain.
I was so excited about this trip. I'd been really, really looking forward to it and practicing really hard, and I was really committed to it, and I thought it was going to be a really good story. I was very excited, and then the few weeks before, I started to get very nervous because I was so bad at the violin, and I really didn't think I was going to earn any money, and it was going to be a disaster. I woke up that morning in Vigo, went down to the harbour, which is where Laurie Lee first saw a foreign country, and he disembarked in the harbour. I walked up through the harbour into the town square, looking for somewhere to busk, but mostly looking for reasons to procrastinate. And I just walked around the town for about 2 hours, just thinking, oh no, this street's not quite right for some obscure reason. And in my head, I was thinking, maybe I should be allowed a few euros a day, or maybe... And I was just thinking of reasons why I could quit, or why I could justify quitting straight away. And eventually I got hungry, I ran out of reason to procrastinate, and I found this little square. I got out my violin case, I unzipped it, with just a few people sitting around. And I felt, as Laurie Lee does in his book, he describes the moment of going from being just a normal person in the street to suddenly being different. You take out the violin and you're different.
This is ridiculous. Oh man, I'm feeling like an absolute idiot right now, accompanied by the town drunkards. What they will make of it, I don't think they'll be very impressed, to be honest. Right.
If you're someone who doesn't like making a fool of yourself, isn't very musical, is a bit shy, then suddenly standing in a town square playing at all would be nerve-wracking. If I had to do it right now, I'd be nervous doing it. But if I had to do it right now, knowing I had no money in my pocket and the only way I was going to get any was by playing, is extra frightening, but also becomes the incentive to just get on and do it. What surprised me, all this nervousness and worry that I keep banging on about, when I actually got the violin out and started to play the first screechy notes, I just started laughing. I just found it funny. And I realised what is, of course, very obvious, that no one cared. People walking past would just continue to walk past. If people found it funny, they'd laugh and then walk on. If people found it bad, they'd wrinkle their nose and walk past. That's the worst that was going to happen. I was this fear of rejection and being a fool is so stupid in front of total strangers, and I just found it very, very funny.
Guantanamera. Más o menos.
And your first night in Spain, in the book, there's a, well, I say a really vivid description. They're all really vivid descriptions, aren't they? But of Laurie Lee as he woke up the next morning, I think he had a disturbed night listening to the wolves. But often those times of greatest doubt come when we're lying there wanting to go to sleep, and you had very little with you in terms of camping equipment. You've got no money. What was it like that first night?
By the time it got to my first evening, I'd already earned a few precious coins and I'd broken that duck, and earning the first money the first morning in Vigo was such a massive moment. I remember so clearly the first gentleman who gave me a coin, and he gave me hope, really. And I then knew that with that coin, I could buy a bag of rice. With a bag of rice, I could walk for 1 week, maybe 2 weeks if I eked it out, and that suddenly everything became possible. So I walked out of town that first day and found the place to camp very near where Laurie Lee spent his first night. And by then I was just jubilant. I was just so pleased that I hadn't chickened out that first morning. I was so pleased I'd stuck to my guns and not taken any money, and I was just really, really excited that first night.
I lay on my belly, the warm earth against me, and forgot the cold dew and the wolves of the night. I felt it was for this I had come, to wake at dawn on a hillside and look out on a world for which I had no words, to start at the beginning, speechless and without plan, in a place that still had no memories for me.
Well, I've been playing for 2 hours now with absolutely nothing, nada. Zilch, squit, diddly pop. So I decided that it's time for some bit of divine help. Oh, gracias. Gracias.
Alistair's days quickly settle into a routine of walking, busking and sleeping. His route takes him always southeast towards Madrid, hopping from town to town, often living on the edge of hunger.
I was pretty hungry in the early days of it, until I learnt the knack of busking, the knack of buying cheap. I've spent a lot of time in my life doing adventures, eating very cheap food and sleeping on hard ground. So for other people, that would have been a really big deal, and the violining would have been easy. For me, it was the other way around. That didn't really bother me.
There's a wonderful piece of film after a woman has given you a peach, and you sort of eulogise this peach, stare at it for a long time before finally tearing into it. Tell me about that.
I was in a town one lunchtime, and it was a village, actually, and I was really disappointed because on my map I'd planned, when I get to that place, it'll be big enough to play, and I need to be able to play because I need money to get to the next town. And I deliberately spent all of my money every day, so that I was always skint and always worried about the next one. I arrived in this village, and instantly I could tell it was too small to play. I wouldn't have earned any money there. I was quite despondent, and I talked to this lady and explaining my trip, and she said, "Well, sorry, I haven't got any money on me now, but here's a peach." And I hadn't eaten anything as luxurious or as nutritious as that for days. And so firstly, her kindness really struck me. It always does when you're travelling, the kindness of strangers. But then a peach, and yeah, the video is almost a bit gross. I'm sort of sniffing it and licking it.
Oh, it's almost too good. Oh, mama. Oh. When I get home and I have money again, I'm gonna have peaches every single day.
I was so excited. I said, when I get home, I'm gonna eat a peach every single day for the rest of my life. And I ate it absolutely delighted. And now I'm home again. There are thousands of peaches in towns. I have credit cards in my pockets. I haven't bothered to buy a peach since. It's not about the peaches, it's about the gesture and the scarcity, I think.
The next day I remember only vaguely. It was one of the hottest of that Spanish summer. No doubt I should have stayed at the inn till the worst was over, but the journey had become a habit. Toro was deserted when I left it, its shutters still drawn, and a brassy glare hung over the plain. The road ran through the wheat as straight as a meridian, like a knife cut through a russet apple, and I followed it east towards the morning sun, which was already huge and bloated. After a while, being outdoors became a hallucination, and one felt there was no longer any air to breathe, only clinkered fumes and blasts of sulphur that seemed to rise through cracks in the ground. I remember stopping for water at silent farms where even the dogs were too exhausted to snarl, and where the water was scooped up from wells and irrigation ditches and handed to me, warm and green.
There's quite a lot of the description in the first part of the book is just about the heat, and clearly something that Laurie Lee had never experienced before, that level of heat. And there's actually a section where you read it now and you realise he's got really bad heat stroke and dehydration, and you know, was in quite a bad way. As you're sort of trekking through the plains before you got to the mountains, did you experience that same sort of heat? I mean, you were out there in the middle of the summer.
People kept saying to me that I was mad to be walking through there in summer, and I agreed, but that was the time Laurie Lee went, and therefore that's why I was there. It was ferociously hot. I had an advantage over Laurie Lee in that I've been to hot places before. I knew that I should wear a hat, and I treated dehydration with water rather than alcohol, which was what his preferred medication. So it was really, really hot, and I did have to have massive siestas every day with no book, no music to listen to. It was just a month of letting my brain drift, really.
And where did it drift to?
I was really surprised and pleased on this trip that my mind mostly drifted off to happy places. And a lot of adventures I've done previously have all been very physical and therefore very deliberately masochistic, and almost by definition very miserable. If you're enjoying yourself, you're on holiday. If you're suffering, you're on an adventure. So my trips have always been about misery beforehand. But this trip, I actually enjoyed it. The physical bit was within my capability. I was learning to enjoy the violin side, and I was actually happy on a journey, probably for the first time in many, many years.
All these other journeys you've done, you're not happy, you're not enjoying them at the time.
The trip I did walking through the Empty Quarter Desert a few years ago, our working film title right up till nearly when it was released was called A Meaningless Penance, which is a Wilfred Thesiger phrase. And I think a lot of my trips have been meaningless penances, just masochistic misery fests, and only enjoyable retrospectively.
After the hot plains, you reach the mountains, the Sierras. Tell me about the mountains, because this is mountain. We need to know about the mountains.
Well, the mountains, they were big hills, really. Actually, they're quite big. They're 2,500 meters or so, the height of summer. So it's just nice to escape the baking plains. And it's grassy meadows in the lowlands, and then higher up into these pine forests, a lovely fragrant scent of that. And just escaping the heat of the lowlands was a joy. Lots of mountain streams that are very, very cold. Some of the most beautiful mountain walking I've ever done, actually. And what was interesting about it is that it's so near Madrid. You're only about 20, 30 miles from this huge capital city with incredibly beautiful mountains, following the route of an old Roman road. So for thousands of years, people have been crossing the same pass that I walked up and over.
Now, if this trip was a movie, you'd have struggled at the beginning, and then by the end, you'd have been like banging out the tunes like you're in Blazing Fiddles or something. But, you know, life isn't like that.
I definitely improved. I had 5 songs in my repertoire, which, and each song at my level lasts for about 20 seconds. So I'd play those 5 songs on loop for several hours a day, so I definitely got better at them. And actually, by the end, I was almost at the point where I was too good. At the start, I was so ridiculously bad that it was comedy, and then people gave me money. By the end, I started to worry that actually I just sounded rubbish, rather than it being comedy rubbish. I was just rubbish, and therefore not deserving of money at all. Having said that, I never felt that I got anywhere near competent. I came to have enormous admiration for anyone who can graft hard enough to make a violin sound beautiful.
So you had early on started to fill that role of the hapless foreign busker who had no idea what he was doing, and then by the end you came out of that category.
Well,
that's success,
that
isn't might, it?
That, yeah, I suppose so. Well, what is success is that every town I went to, I earned a bit of money. My lowest was about €2.30 in a town. And my most was an extraordinary day when I earned €20 in just over 2 hours. And I just couldn't believe that. I went and bought chorizo and ice cream. And on the way out of town, I was so happy. I then got invited to this street party that was happening outside a bar. A man playing guitar, someone gave me some beers, someone bought me some chicken wings, I was dancing with girls, I got my violin out to play a duet with the guitar guy. That's where it goes, and reality kicked in, because I just could not play a duet at all. Even with him playing my tune, I couldn't do it. But that was a day of absolute glory.
This idea of setting yourself rules in a way, you know, having your credit card in an envelope saying, you know, open this, and it means failure. Does this come about from a sort of expedition inflation? You keep doing bigger and bigger things. And does that make you feel anxious, thinking, what the hell am I going to do next? This is my job.
Well, one of the reasons that I ended up heading down this path was because the path you've just described of always having to do something bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger leads to either you dying, or it leads just to some sort of madness in your head whereby what you've done is not sufficient and you have to do something else. And it's certainly not a route towards any sort of happiness or contentment. And this trip, walking a mere few hundred miles through Spain, a sensible, fine European country in the summertime, is not that hard. But I still regard this now, looking back, as one of the greatest adventures I've ever done. And that's all to do with the other aspects of adventure, not the physical part.
Tell me about the end of the trip, when you walked into Madrid and decided that the last thing you would do would be to earn enough for a beer.
My trip ended in Madrid. Laurie Lee, he was younger and had more time in his hands than me, so he carried on all the way to the south of Spain. My trip ended in Madrid, and I walked into a little bar, and I said to the man in there, "How much does a beer cost?" He said, €2.50. I said, "Thank you very much, I'll be back." Walked off. He probably thought, strange tourist. Walked out into town, got out my violin, and this time I definitely had swagger. I just thought, you know, I could walk into any town in Spain, get out my violin, and I'll earn some money. And right now, I'm going to earn enough for a beer. And I just played until I'd earned my €2.50. I actually earned a little bit more, because when I went back in, I could just slap down all my remaining coins as a tip. And that was the end of the journey. Started with nothing, ended with nothing. A nice cold beer on a street cafe in Madrid. It was a perfect summer.
It's 5 o'clock in Edinburgh. It's November, it's dark, it is freezing. What do you reckon your chances are of getting a couple of quid?
Well, we could rustle up a bit of my Spanish magic and should we see how we get on?
Yeah. Yeah.
We find a busy street and Alistair sets up outside a hairdresser's. There are half a dozen clients viewing us quite suspiciously through the window. Alistair is tuning up his violin and I'm grasping a microphone in one hand and a penny whistle in the other. I brought the whistle with me, thinking I could skulk in the shadows and perhaps play a note or two to accompany Alistair, who is confidently taking control as the senior partner in this impromptu gig. But this is a brightly lit street, and there are no shadows to skulk in. And then Alistair pushes me forward. It's my turn to feel the fear. So we're standing here on Edinburgh Street in the dark, and I'm feeling sick to my stomach.
This is your busking debut.
Yeah, I've got my whistle, and I'm not that happy about this, actually.
But let me hold your microphone, because you've been telling me, and I believe you, you're much better than me at music, aren't you? So now Mountain Podcast roving reporter. Chris, how are you feeling? This is the first time you've ever busked.
I feel absolutely horrible.
Do you really?
Yes. I don't know what I'm going to play.
Why are you feeling horrible?
Because I'm just nervous and unprepared.
Okay. Here we go. Here comes the lady. Just make sure you get eye contact and smile at her and go for it.
Oh, yes.
How much have you earned?
5p, 12p.
Congratulations.
That's all I need to do.
It's your busking debut. How do you feel now, having earned some money?
Now I feel really good. Yeah.
Can you see how it's quite a thrill?
It is a thrill. It's a thrill. I'm going to go straight to a pub and slap that down the bar and see what it gets me.
Oh.
Ah, dear. There we are.
That's one less thing to do in life.
Shall we quit while we're ahead?
I think we should quit while we're ahead.
I met my girl by the gasworks hall. I dreamed a dream by the old canal. I kissed my girl by the factory wall. It's a dirty old town. It's a dirty old town.
I really was proud of myself on this trip, and you mentioned it, a movie arc. If this had been a movie, what should have happened was that there'd be all sorts of terrible things happen, and then eventually I'd scrape to the finish line. But actually on this, the reality is that all the terrible things that happened were inside my head before day one. My worries, my nerves, my self-doubts, my insecurities. And then I stood up and actually did the thing instead of thinking about it. And about an hour later, a nice gentleman gave me euro, and from then on the trip was just wonderful from start to end. It taught me for about the 1,000th time in my adventuring career that things are rarely as bad as you worry they're going to be, and that you should just get on and start it. And the worst thing that's going to happen is probably not the worst thing you've been imagining.
So when you're standing in a public square in front of a bunch of strangers about to screech out "Twinkle, twinkle," are you thinking, "Oh yeah, I've nailed my life here. This is what it's all about."
And then counting the grubby pennies and being excited when I can afford a tomato. Absolutely, that is living the dream, I think.
Alistair Humphreys. A massive thanks to Alistair for sharing his story. Editing help was from Hugh Williams, who also read the extracts from Laurie Lee's book As I Walked Out One Midsummer Morning. The book is published by Penguin. Please, please go and read it. Music for this episode was from Blue Dot Sessions, Ennio, Kai Engel, Vivaldi, played by John Harrison with the Wichita State University Chamber Players, Loch Lomond and David Mumford. A special thanks to Niall Grimes and the excellent Jamcrack podcast for letting us use Sean Villanova O'Driscoll's version of Dirty Old Town. Our website is mountainpodcast.com. Go there to find links to our newsletter, Twitter feed, and our Facebook page. Do you know every time you share an episode on Facebook, Mountain gets more subscribers? This is very welcome. Please keep doing it. Thank you, and thanks for listening today. I'm Christopher Slight, and this is Mountain.
Self in a hurricane.